Good afternoon and welcome to the Center for Strategic International Studies. I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm the Chief Communications Officer here at CSIS. My friend Bob Schieffer started an event last week by just saying, in other news, so we'll you're here for other news. And this is interesting news. We have the famous Pew poll here today. And, you know, my Twitter feed started clicking, you know, Pew, 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 sometime last night. It hasn't stopped because the results of this poll have just jumped out at everybody. Richard Weick is here. He's the author of the poll and the study, and he's going to present its findings first. After that, we're going to follow up with a discussion with Richard and my colleagues Heather Conley and Mike Green. Heather is our Senior Vice President for Europe and Eurasia. Mike is our Senior Vice President for Asia. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Richard to present the findings. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks to Heather and Mike. Thanks to CSIS for hosting this. Thanks to all of you for being here. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk a little bit about this report, which we did just release last night at 6 o'clock. And we look at what people around the world think about the United States. We have been doing surveys at Pew now internationally for over a decade and a half, and we look at a lot of different topics in our surveys, but this is the one that we've come back to repeatedly over the years. And I think one of the reasons we've done it is because it's been a really interesting story. We've seen some highs, we've seen some lows over the last decade and a half. And truthfully, in this survey, it's mostly lows. We see that President Trump remains unpopular internationally. We see that ratings for the United States remain lower than they were during the Obama era. Most of those we surveyed say that they don't think the U.S. takes into account the interest of countries like theirs when it's making foreign policy decisions. Many say that they don't see the U.S. doing as much to address global problems as it has in the past. And a lot of these criticisms of the United States are most common among some of our best allies and partners. Now, there are some exceptions to this overall pattern as well. There are some countries where President Trump gets pretty good ratings, and we'll take a look at those exceptions as well. And we'll also take a look at public opinion around the world regarding the balance of power. One of the interesting findings, I think, from the survey is that big majorities in most of the countries that we polled say they see China's power very much on the rise. But when you ask them, which country would you like to see as the leading global power in the future, they overwhelmingly say the United States. So what I'll do is walk through a few slides that highlight some of the key findings from the report, and then we'll have a discussion, and you know, happy to take some questions as well. So let's see if there we go. Before I jump into the findings, I'll just tell you briefly a little bit about the Pew Research Center and who we are and what we do. As it says here, we've been around over 20 years now. We're funded largely by the Pew Charitable Trust, although we do get funding from other foundations and sources as well. We're nonprofit, nonpartisan, non-advocacy. We don't make policy recommendations. We actually like to call ourselves a fact tank rather than a think tank because we put such an emphasis on data, empirical research, and information. We've been doing international surveys now since 2001. We've been in 108 countries around the world. Still a couple of additional ones I'd like to fill in over the next few years, but we have been around to most of the globe. And I'll put in a plug for the website, pewresearch.org. You can find our reports there, blog posts, op-eds, things like that. We have an interactive feature associated with this report that's pretty cool. And if you're a number cruncher, you have colleagues who are number crunchers, ultimately we put the raw data up there as well so you can download it and use it in your own analysis. A little bit about the methodology of the study. It was conducted in 25 countries around the world. You can see them listed there. In some countries, actually in most of the countries where we do the survey, it's a face-to-face interview. In a few places, Canada, much of Europe, Australia, South Korea, Japan, we do a phone survey. the U.S. really isn't a part of this study for the most part. We really wanted to look at what the world thinks of the United States rather than American public opinion. But we do have some comparable data from the U.S. at a few places in this report. You can see the field dates down here. It was basically done May through August. These are all nationally representative samples, so what that means is that the demographic profile of the people we talk to in each country looks like the demographic profile of that country's population in terms of age and gender and education and geography, etc. Here you can see the countries that we surveyed in. Obviously a few places we'd like to have on that map, but we try to do a good job of getting a pretty good representation of countries from regions across the globe. And as you can see, we put a particular emphasis this year on Europe. We have 10 European Union countries in this study. So I'll get into some of the findings. And start off with two really kind of baseline measures of what the world thinks about the United States. U.S. favorability, a very simple question. Do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of the United States? And confidence in the U.S. president. This is a question now we've asked about three different presidents. We ask it about a lot of world leaders. How confident are you in that leader to do the right thing in world affairs? Those are basically our two kind of baseline measures of what the world's thinking about the U.S. So across the 25 countries that we surveyed, we see that overall there's not a lot of confidence in President Trump. So across these 25 countries, a median of 70% say they do not have confidence in President Trump to do the right thing in world affairs. A median of only 27% says they do have confidence in him to do the right thing in world affairs. So, you know, overwhelmingly, and we saw this last year as well, not a lot of confidence globally in President Trump. Here's the favorability question. On balance, favorable, a median of 50% say they have a favorable opinion of the U.S. But, you know, the margin's not very big, 50 favorable versus 43 unfavorable. And that number is down significantly in most countries from what we saw towards the end of the Obama era. Now, this chart kind of represents our long-term trend in our surveys in terms of, you know, what have we seen regarding American presidents and overall attitudes towards the U.S. So this is data from four Western European countries that we've surveyed pretty consistently over the last decade and a half. And this is that confidence measure that we asked about President Bush, then about President Obama, and now about President Trump. So if you look at the numbers for Bush, you know, he starts out not especially getting good marks, and they actually go down throughout the course of his presidency in Western Europe. So there's, as you all know, a lot of opposition to key elements of Bush's foreign policy. He wasn't especially popular in the region, and his numbers were pretty low. Comes in 2009, and he gets these sort of astronomical ratings, you know, more than 9 in 10 having positive views about him in France and Germany in 2009 after he takes office. They move around a little bit over the years, but you know, he leaves office still getting very positive marks in Western Europe. And then you can see the downward trend, a pretty sharp one, over the last couple of years in terms of attitudes towards President Trump. 1 in 10 or fewer in Germany and Spain and France say they have confidence in him. His numbers are up a little bit in the UK, but still, you know, overall, low numbers in the UK, low numbers in Europe. And this trend is especially dramatic in Western Europe, but over the last decade and a half, we've seen a lot of trends that look something like this in the countries that we've surveyed. And now, I won't go through each one of these in detail, but we can walk through just a little bit the country-by-country findings in this year's survey in terms of the percentage of people who have confidence or who lack confidence in President Trump. So, as you can see, in Canada, 75% say they do not have confidence in him. Now, obviously, this data was collected before the NAFTA or the new NAFTA agreement that's happened, so we don't know what impact that might have had, but this is consistent with what we've seen over the past couple of years. You know, very negative attitudes towards Trump and Canada, and that's had an impact on America's image. Mostly negative throughout the European countries that we've surveyed, a little less so in Hungary and Poland. Again, this is consistent with what we've seen. Those European nations are a little bit more positive about Trump than their neighbors, although, you know, the data still leans in a negative direction even in Hungary and Poland. Russia, just 19% confident in President Trump this year. That's actually a pretty big decrease from last year when he got much more positive numbers in Russia. And his numbers are down there. Ratings for the U.S. are down there. And I think that's consistent with what some other Russian polling has shown as well. Same question in the other countries that we polled. Asia, as you can see, a mix of views, you know, mostly negative in Japan, Australia. South Korea, mostly negative, although Trump's numbers have improved a bit in South Korea over the past year. Philippines, he gets his best ratings on the survey. Nearly 8 in 10 in the Philippines say they have confidence in him. Now, that's pretty consistent with what we've seen over the years in terms of views of the U.S., views of the American president in the Philippines. I think at one point Obama may have gotten a rating, a positive rating from more than 90% of those we polled in the Philippines. So high numbers for him, but that's not unusual in the Philippines. Big differences in the two Middle Eastern countries that we surveyed, very negative in Tunisia, very positive in Israel. We'll look more at Israel in just a moment. In sub-Saharan Africa, this is also typical with what we've seen over the years. We tend to get high ratings for the U.S. and for American presidents in sub-Saharan Africa. And then in Latin America, overwhelmingly negative right now in terms of their views, or at least in the three countries we surveyed, towards President Trump. Just 6% in Mexico said they have confidence in him. That's his lowest rating on the survey. I believe it's 66% in Mexico say relations have gotten worse over the past year. Last year we asked about the wall. More than 9 in 10 Mexicans said they opposed the building of the wall. So, you know, Mexico stands out in our survey with as a country with especially negative views towards President Trump. In this year's poll, same was true in last year's poll as well. Now, one of the things we see in Europe is that people who have a positive view of right-wing populist parties tend to also have a more positive view of President Trump. So if you look at the UK, for example, among those who have a favorable view of UKIP, 53% of those people say they have confidence in Trump. It's just 21% among those who have an unfavorable opinion of UKIP. And you see a similar pattern in these other countries, Sweden, France, Italy, the Netherlands, regarding AFD, views of AFD in Germany. So there is a clear pattern here, although it's also worth noting that, you know, even among the people we surveyed in Europe who have a favorable opinion of these right-wing populist parties, in general, you don't get a majority even among them saying they have confidence in Trump. So the numbers are still generally pretty low, but they are higher among those who support right-wing populist parties in Europe. Here's the question about whether you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of the United States. This shows the percentage of people in each country who have a favorable view of the U.S. in the survey. If you start out over here in the Western Hemisphere, it's 39% in Canada. That's the lowest percentage we've seen in any of the polling we've done in Canada over the last decade and a half. 32% in Mexico. I think it was 30% last year. You know, those are the two lowest numbers we've seen in Mexico over the years. Somewhat better in Brazil. Low in Argentina. That's pretty consistent. We typically see more negative views towards the U.S. and Argentina than elsewhere in Latin America. High in the three sub-Saharan African countries that we surveyed. You know, again, that's pretty typical. Sub-Saharan Africa was the one part of the world we didn't see the rise in anti-Americanism during the Bush era. He was fairly popular in the region. His policies were, he got good ratings, the U.S. got good ratings during the Bush years. That was true during the Obama years, and we still mostly see that in the Trump era as well. In Asia, as you can see, a mix of views, you know, very high in South Korea and the Philippines. We'll take a look at Japan in more detail in just a moment. Again, the ratings are down in Russia. And then in Europe, we've got a separate map to break that out. in a little more detail. You see that attitudes are mostly underwhelming, essentially, in Europe and most of the countries that we surveyed, but it does vary a little bit. It's in the 30s in terms of favorable views of the U.S. and the Netherlands and Germany and France and Greece, much higher in Hungary, and then in, especially in Poland, you see much more positive views towards the U.S. So there is some variety among the European countries that we surveyed. Now, I thought it'd be useful to look at a few different examples of how these two measures have tracked over time in some of the countries that we surveyed, including some key allies of the United States, starting with Germany. So, you know, you can see here's that favorability measure, the sort of green line, and then the blue line is confidence in the U.S. president. And, you know, we saw that line earlier. You know, the confidence in the president went down in the Bush era, goes up very high during the Obama years, drops down a little bit there. I believe that was 2014, maybe, after the NSA story broke, and it turned out we might have been listening in on the phone conversations of Angela Merkel, which didn't play too well in Germany, and the numbers came down a little bit then. But they bounce back. Obama leaves office very popular, and then you can see the decline for Trump in the last couple of years. And the favorability line also moves around basically in sync with that confidence in the president line. So what you end up with is a country in Germany right now that you know, has both sort of low ratings for President Trump and relatively low ratings for the United States. Slightly different pattern for Japan. If you look at attitudes towards the U.S. president in Japan, it moves around a somewhat similar pattern to what we've been seeing, you know, lower during the Bush era, bounces up under Obama, and then lower again now in terms of views about President Trump. But the favorability measure hasn't moved as much. It's never gone below 50%. It bounces up very high after the tsunami, up to 85% when after the U.S. had provided aid to Japan following the earthquake and tsunami. And it's stayed mostly high since then, including, you know, going back up again in this year's survey. So in Japan, what you see is a country that still has pretty low ratings for President Trump, but the overall rating for the United States has, you know, stayed pretty high. And then a third pattern is Israel. It's a country where both U.S. favorability and attitudes about President Trump are pretty positive right now. The favorability line, the green line there, really hasn't moved that much over the years. It's never gone below 70%. In the last few years, it's barely budged at all. It's been in the low to mid 80s. If you look at the confidence in the president line, it has moved more. It dipped down towards the end of the Obama era, when there was a lot of tension between the Obama administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu over the Iran nuclear deal, bounced back last year under President Trump, and then is even more, has increased even more in this year's survey. You know, of course, a lot has happened since we last polled. The U.S. has formally withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal. We've moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Those things seem to have potentially had a positive impact on Israeli public opinion about President Trump. Another thing we wanted to do is look at how attitudes towards President Trump compare with those towards other world leaders. So we asked the same question about four other world leaders, Angela Merkel, Macron, Xi, and Putin. And these are median percentages across the 25 countries that we polled. And as you can see, Angela Merkel is the only one among these five leaders that essentially breaks into positive territory. Across the 25 countries we polled, you get a median of 52% saying they have confidence in her to do the right thing in world affairs. Now, Macron doesn't quite break the 50% line, but on balance, people do actually have positive attitudes towards him as well. That's not true of Xi or of Putin or of Trump. But also, as you can see, Trump actually gets the most negative ratings in the survey across the 25 countries we studied. So, you know, negative for Xi and Putin and Trump, but especially negative for Trump. We like to look at various measures of soft power. We like to ask questions about America's role in world affairs. We have a little bit of that in this year's survey as well, including this question, which we've been asking since 2008. Does the U.S., does the United States government respect the personal freedoms of its people, yes or no? So again, these are median percentages across all the countries we polled. So you have a median percentage of 51% saying yes, just 37% say no. So this is still something that's something of a soft power asset for the United States. People still tend to think that the U.S. government respects individual liberty, but that percentage has been going down over time, and we'll take a look at that in just a moment. Another question we've asked a lot over time, how much do you think the U.S. Takes into account the interest of countries like yours when it's making foreign policy decisions? And what we see in this year's survey is people tend to say not much. People tend to think that the U.S. basically ignores the interests of their country when making foreign policy decisions. Now, that was true during the George W. Bush era. It was true to a lesser extent during the Obama era, but it was still true. And then those numbers have come back, and you get more and more people saying that the U.S. kind of ignores their interest in world affairs during the Trump years. And then a new question we asked, do you think the United States is doing more, less, or about the same to address global problems than it did a few years ago? And here you get a slight plurality, basically saying that the U.S. is doing less. You get about a third saying about the same, and then not many overall saying more. But as you'll see in a minute, the view that we're doing less is actually especially common among some of our key allies and partners. So here's that question about personal freedoms, and from several European countries that we've surveyed pretty consistently over the years. And as you can see, the percentage of people who say that the U.S. respects the personal freedoms of its citizens has declined in recent years. And you know, one thing that's interesting about this question is that it is down during the Trump era, like some other measures that we ask about, but it actually started declining during the Obama years, in particular after the NSA scandal, the Snowden revelations, Ferguson was happening around that time period, a number of different things that may have contributed to this, but this question actually started declining during the Obama era, and it's continued under the Trump presidency. Here's the question that measures whether people think the U.S. essentially listens to other countries in world affairs. You can see the 2013 numbers in green, 2018 numbers in blue. You take Germany, for example, back in 2013, you had 50% saying that the U.S. takes into account the interest of countries like Germany when making its foreign policy. It's down to 19% in 2013. Similar declines in lots of other countries as well. But it is also worth noting, if you look at those 2013 numbers, they weren't especially high to begin with, right? So this is always something that's been a criticism of the United States in our polling, but it's a stronger criticism now. It's more common now than it was during the Obama era. This question about whether the U.S. is more or less or about the same in terms of its efforts to solve global problems. If you look at some of our key allies, especially in Europe, you see big, big numbers saying less. And Germany and Sweden, it's 3 and 4 saying we're doing less now than we were a few years ago to help solve global problems. A little bit less so in you know, some of the southern European countries, you know, less in places like Greece and Hungary, but among some of our key European partners, you get big majorities saying that, in fact, we're doing less. Same question in Asian nations and in Canada. You know, again, pretty big numbers, maybe not quite as high as we saw in countries like Germany, but pretty big numbers in Australia and Japan. And then a big majority in Canada also saying that we're not doing as much as we were a few years ago to deal with global issues. And then one final topic that, as I said, we like to look at in our surveys is the balance of power, in particular the balance of power between the United States and China. So here are some examples of three different questions we asked about that about that topic in this year's survey, one sort of about the recent past, one about the present, and then one about the future. So one of the questions we ask is do you think that the United States is playing a more important role in world affairs than it was 10 years ago? And then we ask the same question about China. So when we ask it about China, a median of 70% across the 25 countries we polled say that China is playing a more important role than it was a decade ago. Just 31% say this about the United States. So, and here's an example of a very clear consensus among the publics we surveyed that China is playing a more important role. Less so when it comes to the U.S. Now we ask a question about the current economic balance of power in the world. Who do you think is the world's leading economic power? And we give people the option of China, the U.S., the EU, or Japan. Not many people tend to say the EU or Japan. They mostly say it's either the U.S. or China. And by a slim margin, 39 to 34%, you get more people right now naming the U.S., but that's not true in every country. And that question has moved around a little bit over the last decade, depending on what's happening economically and politically in the world. But right now, the U.S. maintains essentially a slim margin on that question. And then a question we ask about the future, you know, which would you prefer, a future in which the United States is the world's leading power or a future in which China is? And here, you know, the clear winner is the United States. People are much more likely to say the U.S. Should be, or the world would be better off if the U.S. is the world's leading power. So here's that question on whether, you know, China is sort of up or down over the last 10 years. You can see the U.S. in here as well. We also asked it about a number of other countries. So these are median percentages across the 25 countries we polled saying that these various nations are either more important, less important, or as important as they were a decade ago. So again, it's 7 in 10 of the people we surveyed saying that China is actually more important. It's a little over 4 in 10 for Russia. And then you can see the others listed here. Germany, you know, fairly high. UK down here at the bottom. And one of the things I think is interesting about this is that, you know, I bet you if you asked a lot of foreign policy experts in the U.S. to kind of rank order these, you might get something that looks pretty similar, actually, right? China's playing a bigger role. Russia's been more assertive. Germany's role in world affairs has sort of stepped up over the last decade. Post-Brexit, UK might be placed down at the bottom. So in some ways, when we ask this question to average citizens around the world, we get some results that might not be all that different from what foreign policy experts might suggest. Here's the question about U.S. leadership versus Chinese leadership, again, among some of our key allies and partners. As you can see, the numbers in terms of people saying they prefer the U.S. to be the world's leading power is pretty high in most of these countries. Except Russia. In Russia, you get a big middle category there, people saying, I don't really want either one. Presumably, they're thinking Russia. We didn't really give them that option in this question, but you know, we do get that in some countries where substantial numbers of people volunteer, they'd rather see neither the U.S. nor China as the top power. Same question in the other countries we surveyed. You know, for the most part, you do see people saying they want U.S. leadership. You get substantial numbers for China in some African nations, in Tunisia, you know, to some extent in Latin America. So there are some exceptions, but you do see on the whole globally people saying they would like to see the U.S. as sort of the leading power in the world. So I think that, you know, that last finding, just to sum up, is a reminder of something that we've seen in our surveys in different ways over the last few years. You know, even when there's a lot of frustration with the U.S., even when there's a lot of unhappiness with whoever's in the White House, there's still a lot that people continue to value about the United States. And still, most of the people in this survey say that they'd like to see the U.S. continue to play a leadership role in world affairs. I'll stop there and look forward to the discussion. Thanks a lot.
Richard, thank you for the excellent presentation. I want to lead the question off with, President Trump is fond of saying that the United States is respected again in the world. Your findings are contrary to that. Is the president wrong?
Well, I'll stick to the data, but I mean, the U.S. is definitely seen in a much more negative light than it was a few years ago. It's not true in every country, but in the vast majority of countries we poll, you see it on that favorability question. People are much less likely to express a a favorable opinion of the U.S. We've seen it in soft power questions we ask. You know, there's still a lot of soft power assets the United States has, but those numbers are lower as well when we ask them around the world. So by and large, on the questions we ask at least, we see much more negative views around the globe too, compared to what we've seen in the past.
Well, I want to put this to both Mike and Heather, who they have a very famous friend who is our one of our trustees. His name's Rich Armitage. And Rich Armitage always said that everyone hates the United States until they've got a problem. And then when there's a problem, the United States is the first people that they run to. What do you think about that, Heather? You work for Secretary Armitage.
He is right, because it speaks to the role of America in the international system designed by and for American security and economic prosperity. And in some ways, one of the most striking things from Richard's presentation to me was this sense of confusion about what the role of the U.S. will be. It was a sort of a third, still the same, not the same, want it to come back. And I think you see that yearning for America to play the role that our allies and our adversaries understood about how we would respond in violations of international norms and try to create coalitions to go tackle problems. And now that has changed so substantially, but we don't know what the future holds or what U.S. leadership will evolve into. So, to me, absolutely, he's right. The international system is based on American leadership, and today, American leadership is a very significant question mark.
Mike?
Well, it's interesting when you disaggregate some of these polls by region, and it was interesting that you had some of those separated by region. And what you see is there are these kind of ecosystems within Europe, within East Asia, within Africa, and the views of the U.S., the views of Donald Trump refract differently depending on who your neighbor is. So in almost all the questions, the closer you live to China, the more you like the U.S. And what struck me the most about the poll result was how Japan, Korea, Australia are disaggregating Donald Trump from the United States. The numbers you had about how important is American leadership to your country, Japan, Korea, Australia, the East Asian countries were 78, 80, 82%, very, very high. And the question about who do you trust, Xi Jinping was lowest in East Asia and deteriorating, by the way. I compared the numbers to last year, and Xi Jinping is going down. If you live in a dangerous neighborhood, you're willing to tolerate a certain amount of eccentricity and unpredictability because you need the U.S. too much, and that's pretty clear in the data. But of course, the pain of that is also evident because the question, do you trust the U.S. to do the right thing for you or to watch your interests, has deteriorated everywhere, including Asia, where there's a recognition of the need for more. They like the U.S., they want the U.S., but are not as confident as they were even a year ago that the administration's looking out for them. Except in Korea, interestingly, which is a separate story we can talk about having to do with the North-South diplomacy and the Kim
Jong-un. Well, let's talk about that. Why in Korea? What's the situation in Korea?
Well, I mean, Korean polls in Korea, by Korean organizations, other polls, polls we've done at CSS on foreign policy elites, are very favorable to the U.S. South Korean attitudes are very positive about the U.S. So that puts something of a floor under it. I think President Trump traumatized the Koreans with the talk of bloody war, bloody nose, and war a year ago. But then his summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un was really brokered by the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in. And it's very rare for Koreans to see their president play such a dynamic, catalytic role. It sort of has tracked with Moon Jae-in's popularity, actually, because they're seen as partners trying to see where this will go with North Korea. The flip side of this is what's true in Japan, where trust in Trump has gone down because they think he's being snookered by Kim Jong-un.
And maybe he's favoring South Korea over Japan in his relationships.
If you follow the diplomacy with North Korea closely, you'll see that most of what the president has said and done tracks with Moon Jae-in's views. And although Abe and Trump have a good personal relationship, most of what President Trump has said and done with respect to North Korea contradicts things that Abe has clearly asked for. And so the South, so I mean, with these polls, of course, people are looking at them through different prisms. And I'm sure in South Korea and in Japan, much more than the rest of the world, they're looking at it through this North Korea diplomacy.
Well, Moon hasn't played golf at Mar-a-Lago yet, but he also didn't give President Trump a golden right. golf club, but it seems like he's a little bit ahead right now.
Yes. I mean, the Abe-Trump relationship may be the best among any of the leaders, but Moon is getting a lot more out of his relationship with the president.
Let's talk about China. Richard, your survey found that a median of 70% of respondents view China as having a more important role in the world order than it did a decade ago. What do you attribute that to?
I think this, you know, as I talked about a little bit, I mean, I think it's interesting that this is an issue that's not only being debated among foreign policy elites and that type of thing. I mean, the rise of China's growing power is something that very much registers with average citizens around the world. And I think we've seen that in a variety of different questions we've asked. But, you know, people have different views about China depending on what question you ask them. I mean, in many parts of the world, even in Asia, where there are real concerns about China, people tend to say that they're concerned about, they tend to say that they welcome Chinese investment. They think China's economic growth is a good thing for their country. But when it comes to the security front, there are a lot of concerns about China. You know, a couple of years ago, we asked some questions basically about the rebalance or the pivot. And we saw that in the Asia-Pacific region, by and large, people welcomed it. You know, they wanted a bigger American military presence in the Asia-Pacific. They wanted TPP, for example. So just as Mike was saying, you know, it's among some of China's neighbors where you see some of these concerns about China being particularly strong, and people particularly welcoming of American involvement in the region.
Is this, to Heather and Mike, is this dangerous for the United States that while our views are, well, our perception of America is decreasing, the role of China increasing? What do you see in this?
Well, from the European lens, I sort of see three key issues. Again, through the survey work, it's China's clarity and where there's now a lot of confusion about U.S. retrenchment, our red lines. So I think that it's clarity, number one. I think, two, particularly in the Trump administration, there is an equality or a parity with an ally and an adversary. In some ways, they're not distinguished. So we place tariffs on allies, we punish allies to leverage them to do some things we would like them to do in the trade space and other space. And then we see with Kim Jong-un more flowery language for an adversary that just a year ago was threatening the United States. So I think that draws some confusion of ally
and that we were threatening
versus,
ourselves.
Exactly, ally versus adversary. The third part, and deep in some of Richard's polling, I thought it was interesting for the EU countries, just looking at Greece and Spain, where there was more favorable ratings of China, or at least, you know, it wasn't, you know, you have China holds 61% of the port of Piraeus. There's economic influence, Spanish refineries. So the economic interests do have, I think, a role to play with allies that may be now having a new relationship economically with China.
That explains South Africa as well. You saw South Africa, their numbers getting closer to China than it was before in terms of favorability. Mike, what do you think?
So the, I think the way people answer this question about global leadership depends on who their neighbor is and how much they hate them. So I think that if you were to put up a poll that showed Greek or Spanish views of Germany and China, you'd find there's an inverse relationship. The more Germany pushes them on economic issues, the more China offers seemingly free money, the more you see China getting more popular. And I, you know, about 10 years ago, when there was a major bid to reform the United Nations Security Council and expand it, Japan, India, Germany, and Brazil all agreed to come in together and make a bid together to become new permanent members of the Security Council. And China organized a group called the Coffee Club of all the countries opposed. And all those countries were the neighbors. So Pakistan didn't want India, Argentina didn't want Brazil, France and Italy didn't want Germany. And so China got this huge economic boon in the UN because it mobilized all the countries that lived next to and had rivalry with. So I think that's partly why you see, I would suspect, Greece, for example, or Spain seeing China so popular. But again, it's striking that in East Asia, where countries live next to China, you don't see that. And on the economic question, I was quite struck. I mean, the question, who is the leading economic power in the world, the countries that were most skeptical of China, or put another way, 67% of South Koreans, 58% of Japanese, the top two countries saying U.S. is the leading economic power, even though those two countries have had huge trading relationship with China, far more significant than Greece or Spain in aggregate, but also as a percentage of the total trade. Korea trades almost twice as much with China as it does with the U.S. And yet the publics know enough to say the U.S. is more powerful economically. And I think part of the reason is because they're so close to China, they've looked at it, and they understand things like the dollar is still overwhelmingly the world's reserve currency. Foreign direct investment flows across the Pacific are overwhelmingly not about China. It's U.S., Korea, U.S., Australia, U.S., Japan, and vice versa. And so in some ways, I think the publics that are most knowledgeable about economic relations with China are the most knowledgeable about American economic power, too. And that may be reflected in the poll and why you see Japan and Korea so bullish on American economic power.
Richard, is that plausible?
I think that's right. And that's pretty consistent with what we've seen over the years. It's actually in China's backyard where you get higher numbers of people saying that the U.S. is the top economic power. And like you said, my guess would be that that's because they have a more realistic sort of assessment of the true economic power of the two nations.
Another number that was also 70% stood out to me. Median of 70% have no confidence in President Trump. Ranks him below Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. What do you all think it means for global attitudes towards the United States that President Trump has joined the ranks of such leaders?
Well, you know, I might point to some of the questions we asked in our survey last year when we first asked about President Trump. We asked about some of his key policies. So we asked about pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, pulling out of trade agreements, pulling out of climate accords. We asked about putting up barriers to people from entering the United States, building a wall on the border with Mexico. And what we saw was a lot of opposition almost across the board to all those policies. So I think one of the takeaways from that was that people around the world generally don't like it when they see the U.S. putting up barriers between itself and the rest of the world, whether that's a figurative barrier in terms of making it difficult for people to enter the United States, or a literal barrier on the border with Mexico. And people don't like it when they see the U.S. withdrawing from its international commitments on things like trade and climate. So I think, you know, at least part of what we're seeing is a negative reaction to key elements of Trump's approach to the world.
Heather?
So I'm going to take a slightly different approach to your question. So why does it matter that leaders are popular or unpopular? It's
right.
Not a, you know, a beauty contest, but we want the popularity gives space, particularly in public.
It's definitely not a hairstyle contest.
Well, you know, I think sometimes we over-personalize this. We say very definitively this is President Bush, President Trump, President Obama. It's much, anyone who's worked in the U.S. government knows, it's much bigger than one individual, though one individual is our representative. But we want popularity to give space for the U.S. government, for our policies to work in those countries. And leadership, by its nature, isn't popular because we're moving countries to do things that they wouldn't normally want to do. They're very comfortable in where they are. We're pushing. But that popularity, or at least favorable opinion, gives us that space to do what we need to do. So it's not about we're popular, he's unpopular. It's what you do with that space and push policy. So my reflection, President Obama was wildly popular in Europe, but there wasn't a lot of pushing for tough issues. I would say there was a bit of retrenchment back, and then having to deal with the crisis with Ukraine sort of propelled it to be more popular. So what concerned me the most is not necessarily the popularity of an individual. It waxes and it wanes, as you've shown over the last 16 years. The favorability question on the United States and America, and this is what concerns me the most, because the soft power, our greatest soft power, has been the world has admired us, imperfect as we are, to achieve something higher and greater, our principles. And if there's a decline in sort of the favorability because they feel we're not living up to those high standards or we're failing too much, that to me, then we become less attractive as a system and as a model. And then you get some confusion about, well, maybe China has a different model or Russia has a different model, or maybe this Western democracy thing isn't so great. And that's where we see the rise of people flirting with illiberalism and authoritarianism because we're not as attractive as we once were. Sorry, that was a long explanation, but I think it transcends the individual into the policies.
So the leaders matter, I think, a lot, but probably the way they matter the most is their interaction with the other leaders, which doesn't, you can't exactly capture in the polls, although the polls may reflect the nature of the relationship between leaders. So for example, George W. Bush did not have good ratings in Germany, but Schroeder ran against him. Schroeder used Bush as a prop in his election, and he drove down, I'm quite certain, Bush's, you know, how he looked in Germany. In other countries, Australia with John Howard, where Iraq was, you know, controversial, Howard didn't run against Bush. They were both conservatives. They liked each other, or Koizumi in Japan. So I think some of the things you see in the polls are the nature of the leaders. The fact that Donald Trump and Shinzo Abe have a good relationship, play golf, probably props up his image in Japan. The fact that Moon Jae-in seems to have gotten Donald Trump to follow his North Korea policy, I think, is the main reason Trump is much more popular in Korea than other places. So the leaders' relations, I think, are probably reflected in these polls. It'd be hard to prove, but I suspect that that's the case.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, same as in Israel.
Yep.
President Obama was not very popular in Israel. He pushed Israel hard to do some things, but he wasn't popular. President Trump's very popular in Israel.
But a lot of that is Netanyahu and Trump's relationship versus Obama and
right,
Trump's.
Right.
The other thing I would say about should we be worried about the popularity of our leader, we should. I mean, for the reasons Heather said, it's not, you know, when I was on the NSC staff, when we thought about what we would do in different crises, when we made contingency plans, North Korea crisis or Taiwan Straits or whatever, India, Pakistan, somewhere on the list of what we would do, as you're getting more desperate, is the president addresses the world. And that the bully pulpit, the role of the president, is a powerful tool in American foreign policy, and it makes you worry that in a crisis, and we haven't really seen one yet in the Trump presidency, that foreign policy tool might not work. And one other thing I'd say is it's interesting, the questions about Macron and Merkel. I wish you'd added Abe of Japan. And the reason I say that is the Lowy Institute in Australia did. They kind of copied you guys in a flattering way. And they asked that question, and Abe outpaced everyone in Australia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I think you would find that in places like Indonesia and Southeast Asia as well. I mention that because American leadership in the world is highly dependent on our president, but also if there are other leaders who are effective and popular and pushing a similar agenda, that will help. And I think the narrative in Asia would be that to some extent, Abe and Japan have limited power compared to the US, but to some extent, Abe is filling that role. That's also actually, frankly, why Trump is less unpopular in Japan, because to an extent, certainly on conservative ranks in Japan, the idea that Japan should do more, that Trump is pushing, it has some resonance in Japan that it may not in, for example, Europe.
Let's talk about Russia. Members of both the public and the media have accused President Trump of cozying up to Putin in Russia. Some have even gone so far to say that President Trump's been compromised by the Russians. But the survey found that over half of Russians say that relations have gotten worse in the past year between the US and Russia, and that in that same time period, the public positive view of Trump has dramatically increased from 53% to 19% in Russia. Why do you think what do you make of the change? Why the change?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we may have seen is that some very high expectations were sort of generated early in the Trump presidency, that and maybe those high expectations have been met among certain parts of the Russian public. This would be beyond my level of expertise about Russia, but I've also seen people who are experts say that the media coverage of Trump and of the United States has changed a lot over the last year or so. Maybe either not as favorable coverage for him within the Russian media, or certainly not as favorable coverage of the United States and American policies toward Russia. So media coverage, again, be beyond my area of expertise, but that could be a factor as well.
Richard, this is precisely why we brought one of the world's leading experts on Russia to this panel. Heather, no pressure.
I think we're all... trying to be students of understanding President Putin and Russia. Well, I think Richard's point is exactly right. There was expectation of a dramatically different policy approach from the United States to Russia. In fact, there was actually Russian coverage of President Trump's unexpected election in the aftermath actually began to be tampered down because you don't have unexpected elections within Russia. We knew very clearly that President Putin would be reelected this year or for another 6 years, and I think they were trying to tamp down some of that. But there was expectation that there would be a sea change, and this sort of gets back to my point on president versus the United States government, where you now have President Trump, particularly at the Helsinki summit, espousing a completely different policy perspective than the national security apparatus in the U.S. government and Congress, of which sanctions have continued to be used. So, to be honest with you, I think most Russians, analysts in Moscow, they don't understand our policy approach. They hear something from the president, they see actions from Congress. So there's great confusion. I think also President Putin has done a very effective job of explaining any Russian economic challenges, of which they are now becoming present as they try to reform their pension system, that everything economically that worsens Russia is because of the U.S. and Western imposed sanctions. It's not because of Russian decisions about its economic reforms. I think President Erdogan in Turkey is doing the exact same dynamic. It's the U.S. policies that are making things difficult. Again, if a leader can deflect responsibility and blame the U.S. for current circumstances, then it, of course, reduces the favorability of the U.S. in that country's perspective.
Generally speaking, the survey found that many believe the United States is doing less to help solve major global challenges than it has in previous years, and that the U.S. is acting only in its own self-interest. What does it mean? Does the United States have obligations as a member of the international community to step up and help where others have not? This is a debate we're having in this country now. Mike, I want to put it to you first.
Well, that result's not surprising when the president gives two speeches in a row in the UN General Assembly saying that what you just described is his policy. It's not surprising message received, and the world gets that that's what he claims is his direction for the country. And then, you know, some people being polled may not care about Paris and climate change, but some do, and there's some very visible things that are being undone. The World Trade Organization, some people think we're one bad decision against us in the WTO from pulling out of the WTO. So there's plenty of evidence for that. But if you were to break this down, not at the macro level, at the micro level, I don't think that, for example, in Northeast Asia, if you were pulling in China, for example, Japanese, Koreans, and Chinese would say that because of North Korea. And I don't think you'd necessarily hear that in Southeast Asia, around the South China Sea, because if it's a salient issue in a part of the world that may not be getting polled, I think you'd find in some cases contradictory evidence. But when the president himself says his policy is to do less, it's not surprising that that's how the world hears the message.
Heather?
Well, I mean, I think this is just my reflection of sort of the last 70 years, our anticipation of the international system is guided and led by the United States.
Right.
We have been slowly trying to unburden ourselves from that leadership responsibility, encouraging allies to do more and take on more responsibility. The American people have certainly signaled that they are not supportive of a very overextended, over-involved America in conflicts in the Middle East and what have you. The problem is the system is built on American leadership. We don't know what that system looks like when it removes itself so clearly, either from trade or from security dynamics. We don't know. And so that, to me, is the great uncertainty as we move forward. So you have a lot of nostalgia in that poll saying, I wish America would go back to how it was. This is a benign power that provided public goods and security and prosperity. I want that system back. But that, to me, it's unclear that is the system that America is going to support. We've had different articulations of America's role in the world going from a very extensive intervention in countries to change how those countries work, to we're not going to be involved in countries like Syria, and then there are consequences for that. And so now we're trying a slightly different model, which is everything. We want to pull back. We want to, and so it's unclear. And I think this is the challenge of the survey. What comes next? And there's total confusion about what that is.
We're also comparing the U.S. role to China's Belt and Road, which was rolled out with huge fanfare, huge numbers thrown around. And our answer is not very clear to that. So it's being compared against a very seemingly enormous Chinese effort. I think, you know, already people are starting to question the scope, the validity, the efficacy of China's Belt and Road. You might find that how people around the world think of the American role is relative to how they see China's role, and that may change as people sort of look at the Belt and Road and see some of the problems from debt traps and infrastructure inefficiencies and so on and so forth. It's not, I think, necessarily a fixed trajectory. What worries me more than the America's playing a role in the world, because that's somewhat aspirational I wouldn't say idealistic, but it's kind of macro. What worries me more is the poll number that shows that in countries that are in some ways more pro-US, like Japan, Korea, Australia, and so forth, or countries that have declining views of China, declining views of Xi Jinping, they also have declining trust the U.S. will do the right thing for them. So I'm a bit more of a realist, and I worry about our alliances a lot, because I don't think the administration has articulated well, this would not be true of Secretary Mattis or Chairman Dunford, but the president has not articulated well to the American people of the world why alliances matter to us. And the numbers showing that by a pretty large margin, all our allies, even the ones who like the U.S. a lot still, all of them think we don't have their back. And if that continues, that to me is more worrisome, because our influence in international institutions in key regions of the world is really, in my view, hanging more on our alliances. And that's a worrisome number. If that trend continues, you don't see it yet. You don't see, you see it a little bit in the Middle East, but you don't see it in Europe and Asia yet in a significant way. I'll speak for Asia. You don't see TPP 11, CPTPP. We're out of TPP, but all the major countries are holding a place for us. You don't see them changing institutions. Every ally in that region wants deeper connectivity. They're buying more American equipment. They're getting more joint and interoperable. You don't see allies hedging yet, at least in Asia. But if that number continues, or if it grows, you might start seeing allies say, look, they don't have our back.
Is that the consequence of this?
It is. That's the consequence. And then when allies think you don't have their back and they start hedging, then the other guys on the other side start driving wedges between alliances, you know, expanding their interests at our expense. We're not at that tipping point in Asia, at least. But that's the most worrisome number in this poll to me, is the growing number of friendly countries and allies who say America doesn't have our back.
And it's not so easy to flip the friend switch on and off, is it?
Well, and I think that's really the confusion, and this is where you're working on an important issue with Prime Minister Abe while you're imposing steel and aluminum tariffs and threatening car tariffs. Same with Canada, same with Germany. I think there's similarity to TPP 11, to the Iran nuclear agreement. We can withdraw, but and it may not hold, but the other parties are trying to hold it together. So what you see is the interim solution is, all right, you leave, that's your decision. We will try to hold it together. But again, it doesn't have the durability, the weight with the U.S. Engaged in it. It can move on, and these countries will move on. They will make decisions. They may not be optimum for themselves. The problem is there's just not, where's the hedging? Where's the hedging strategy going to go? For right. Europe, it's not going to be a full embrace of Russia. It's someone that's violating Europe's territorial integrity, challenging it from internal malign influence. China, there's been a slow wake up that China's economic influence carries a lot of different weight, both political as well as from a technological standpoint. Where do they go other than try to hold the line? And I worry that of Europe's fragility, they're going to have a difficult time holding the line until we either return or we really go in a permanent different direction.
Richard.
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think this set of issues is one of the things that makes this moment a little bit different from maybe the rise in anti-Americanism we saw around much of the globe during the Bush era. I mean, that was the era of the hyperpower and Mr. Big and all these types of things. And in the minds of many of the people we surveyed, at least, it was sort of, their concerns were about unrestrained, as they saw it, American power being exercised around the world.
Cowboy diplomacy.
And that kind of thing. And then what we see now, I think, is more about a negative reaction to a perceived American withdrawal. Again, you know, the U.S. pulling out of major agreements, the U.S. doing less to help solve world problems. So, you know, on a lot of those charts I showed, the numbers look similar to maybe what you saw in 2008, but I think the dynamics behind those numbers might be a little bit different.
Well, so along those lines, I think one of the biggest declines in favorable views of the U.S. came from our historic allies,
yeah.
Canada, France, Germany. What actions do you think we need to take in order to correct this perception, or are we past being able to correct it for the moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first year of the Trump administration, our allies were coming very quickly. The first person in the Oval Office was Prime Minister Theresa May of the United Kingdom. They wanted to create that relationship, that dynamic, that leader to leader. I think our allies have tried to understand what motivates and animates the president, so they come in with business leaders talking about the economic relationship. They come in talking about their investment in the United States. But what they found over the last 18 months is that the things that they felt that was the glue of America's allies, our security relationship, our economics, are something that we will, that the President Trump will flirt with totally disintegrating. So the tariff conflict, the president's comments on the margins of the NATO summit, you know, we could go it alone. At NATO, it's just fundamentally undermined the theory of America playing a pivotal role in global trade. And our security relationship. So I think now they've sort of, they tried to invest, they've tried to find an equilibrium where they can ride this out, but you can tell, with the exception of one or two of the European allies, they're staying away. They're trying, again, very unpopular at home, they also have their challenges at home. Looking at Chancellor Merkel's and President Macron's favorability ratings, they're more favorable outside, I think, right now than they are inside their countries. They're having a very dynamic political contestation within their own countries and economic issues. So all it does is it complicates what they're trying to do. So I think in some ways we're in year two. They're trying to keep the distance and prevent damage from happening. But I think there's a real question about what the next 2 years will mean for them from the tariff economic perspective, and then sort of where NATO goes from here and the future of the U.S. engagement with the NATO.
Even the new NAFTA, USMCA, it sounds like us versus them. It's not the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's us versus them. I don't know that that's necessarily going to heal much. Very contentious agreement.
It is indeed, and I think it'll be very curious to see next year Canada's ratings, that can you get over, it's been very unpleasant, it's very contentious, but we have the agreement, move on, or it is a lasting sense that something has moved historically, and our allies really have to keep us at a distance for their own political stability, but also they're just not sure which way we're going to turn.
You know, I'm not sure I would say that our closest allies are the most negative about us. That's not actually exactly right if you look at the polls, because of Japan and Korea and Israel, who are very favorably inclined to us because they live in dangerous neighborhoods. But it is Canada, it is Mexico, it's the UK, and to some extent Australia. And so I wonder if what that reflects is the countries that share our values the most deeply. Open societies with immigration, multicultural, struggling with the same issues we're struggling with in some ways. And perhaps for people in Canada, in Britain, perhaps some of the decisions the administration's made on immigration and things like Charlottesville are much more deeply painful than for a country like Japan or Korea or even Israel. And which raises the question, how much of this is sibling, you know, sort of deep disappointment in value system we share versus geopolitics. And I suspect it's more of the former, that we're not going to see Canada. Mexico may be a different story. But I don't think Canadian foreign policy is going to be, particularly after this UMCA agreement, is going to be dramatically different. I think we're going to be cooperating more with Canada next year than we did last year in Asia, for example. But Canadians, I think, because we share such a common and close kinship and sense of values in our societies and cultures, I think they're deeply, deeply sort of pained, offended by what some of the things they see. I suspect it's hard to prove with this data, but we're not at a fact tank, we're at a think tank. So I think that there may be a reason that you see the cousins, the societies most like us, being so pained and negative, whereas close allies who share democratic values with us but are different kinds of societies, like Japan, Korea, and arguably Israel, you'd know better, maybe are able to tolerate it better. I mean, the immigration debate in Japan is not really a debate, for example.
Like, I think it's both. I think obviously it's the geopolitics, but it's also the values. And, you know, to John McCain's famous, you know, our values are our interests. Our interests are our values. And I think it's our allies that feel that the values proposition has been shaken and a big question mark, which starts throwing into doubt whether our security relationships are there, or the economic ties are there to be durable. So I would put those.
I think that's probably right. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think the difference is in part because societies like Canada and the UK are more like us. But I do think the values thing matters. And one reason you see the deteriorating numbers from countries like Japan or Korea about whether the US will do the right thing, I think one reason is because we don't talk about our values. I mean, it's just a sort of footnote on that. The Japanese government came up with a strategy called the Free and Open Indo-Pacific Strategy, arguing that we believe in democratic norms and open sea lanes and societies in Asia. And the administration originally agreed with Japan. We've dropped free and open from that. The president doesn't talk about values. You know, Abe and even Modi in India, these other countries talk about democratic values because it's glue. It's part of why they think we have their back, because we care about them as democracies. And if our narrative, at least coming out of the Oval Office, is, I mean, that speech in the UN, you know, the countries he admires were neutral. There was no common denominator in terms of value system or democratic norms for the leaders he talked about, especially Poland right now. And if you're depending on the United States to come to your defense, in part because we value them as democratic allies, that would be unnerving, to Heather's point. And it is, I can tell you, in a lot of the world.
I mean, is it popular for Trudeau to run against Trump at this point?
Well, I mean, we'll see next year's election. We'll see where, you know, I tend to think political forces have to fight the battles on their local front. The example of Chancellor Schroeder, actually, it failed, and Chancellor Merkel was elected in 2005. I think, yes, it can gin people up, but ultimately people care that their political leaders are focusing on the issues that they need to care about. But Canada is very vulnerable. If we really scramble our trade relationship, that makes Canada very vulnerable. And I think for me, the reflection is the president doesn't see the unique value of an ally as an amplification of American power. He sees it as a weakness and a leverage point that he can exploit, whether that's the Koreans in trade or the Canadians. And we don't want to leverage our allies in a negative way. We want to help them, because when they prosper, we grow our trade, we grow our security, they amplify our interests and our message. But that is not how the administration views allies, unfortunately.
Let's open it up to some of your questions. I believe we have a microphone. Do we have a microphone that we can bring up to the front row? Gentleman right here in the front. If you could tell us who you are, that'd be great.
My name is Walter Jurasek. I'm Polish-American Congress member. Thank you for mentioning Poland.
You can ask him.
And by the way, Poland was the oldest democracy, one of the oldest democracy in the world. So I have a conflict with the survey, with your survey, because Poles do fight for freedom like United States did before. And thanks to Poles, Tadeusz Kościuszko, they fought for the United States freedom. But I'm not going into that. I want to see this survey between Obama popularity and Trump popularity, which you just surveyed. So let me put this way. I travel all over the world because I am my interest and job. And I survey my own, from my own interest. I don't survey the politicians. There's a little bit difference what you survey and what I survey. Because I go directly to the roots on the common Joe. Okay? And I, when I see the survey, I will challenge upside down. Because Obama administration was popular in center of this rock. Okay. Because of the globalization. So Trump doesn't believe in globalization, which is nothing but caste system, and the media 24 hours against Trump in Europe and in US.
Sir, do you have a question?
So my question, how did you do the survey? Did you ask ever the common Joe what he thinks about the United States?
Short answer is yes. Yes, we surveyed average citizens in these countries, and the demographic profile of the people in our sample that we surveyed looks a lot like the demographic profile of the country's population. So it's young people, old people, it's men and women, it's in rural areas, it's in urban areas, etc. So, in terms of who we reached, it looks like the population of a given country.
Questions? Right here in the front.
My name's Frederick Ruiz Ramon. I work for a small consulting firm, but I used to be in the Department of Defense working international relations. And my question is on the survey, is there a way to tease out from the surveys that you did so that we can distinguish between some of these high-level trends that our speakers were talking about and the flavor of what the United States? So for example, I heard the term cowboy diplomacy. I think that was referring to the fact that we were invading Iraq, that we were participating with the use of force, which was one type of power, as opposed to, say, intervening economically today, if we were to do it in Central America, as a different way to address immigration versus walls. So it's the flavor of the way the US participates in the world, perhaps, as opposed to the withdrawal of the US from the world. And I don't know if you can tease that kind of stuff out of the data or not.
Yeah, and I think it's a good question. I think that over time we've tried to do some of that. We've tried to look at different elements of American power, I guess. American economic power, investment, things like that. American military power in Iraq or Afghanistan, or the use of drone strikes during the Obama years. American soft power and cultural power and things like that. So, not all that is actually in this one survey, but over time I think we have. Often you see a lot of reservations about the use of American military power, again, whether it was Iraq and Afghanistan or the use of drones during the Obama years. American economic power is generally kind of welcomed more around the world. We see enthusiasm for American investment, for example, and we've asked questions about that. And on the soft power front, the U.S. continues to have a lot of assets in terms of soft power. American culture is widely embraced, for example. But soft power is in decline in some ways too, as we saw in that question about whether the U.S. respects personal freedom. So, I think in terms of how to approach this kind of research, your suggestion is a very good one. We need to disaggregate American power and disaggregate these different elements of America's image and try to look at them separately as much as we can. It's often pretty tough to do in one survey, but if you add up a lot of surveys that we've conducted over the years, I think you can get a pretty good picture of it.
If I can briefly piggyback on that, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, but the Pew survey is a survey of attitudes, not choices. And there are other surveys, Chicago Council to some extent. We've done elite survey polling here in Asia about choices, where we present a hypothetical and who are you going to call, where are you going to invest, where do you want to send your kids to school. And when you start doing not attitudes but choices, the US does much better. So even though people may have a negative attitude towards us, when you ask questions about where you want to go and send your kids to school, who would you want to invest and so forth, and some of that comes out of your polls, you find that the US actual standing is pretty good. Just anecdotally, I'm a professor at Georgetown, and I can tell you that international students coming to the US, I think the number's gone down about 15%, something like that. I may be a bit off since 2000. In 2017-18. So there are some choices being made that do suggest we've lost a little bit of our mojo. There could be other factors, economic factors, visas, but the macro point I make is that sometimes choices are not the same as attitudes. which we, to your question, have to keep in mind.
Great questions. In the back.
Hi, Rubey is World Council of Churches, retired. The data on Israel and Trump, the connection, is this going to reflect, if this trend continues, the partnership between Israeli politics and Trump politics, if this continues, will this affect Israel's security and attitude of Americans in general, particularly the Democrats on Israel in the future?
Well, you know, it's hard to sort of predict what's going to happen in terms of how future policies might affect future attitudes. I mean, what I'd say is that overall, Israeli attitudes towards the U.S. remain, you know, very positive. They've been pretty consistently positive over time, regardless of who's in the White House. So you see a little bit of fluctuation. Certainly there were tensions between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama, and that led to a little bit of a dip in his ratings. But you know, if you look across what we've seen over the last decade and a half, the overall opinion is very, you know, is very positive, both towards the U.S. and generally towards American presidents. Now, there are some differences within Israel at times. President Obama got much lower ratings, for example, among Likud party supporters. President Trump is just the opposite. He tends to get very high ratings among Likud party supporters. So, you know, there are some internal divisions within Israel that you see reflected in Israeli attitudes towards the U.S., but the overall picture is one that's, you know, very, very positive.
And I would just say that in the United States, support for Israel has been a bipartisan value for many, many years. And you see that even if President Obama wasn't as popular in Israel as President Trump is, the United States Congress was still fully behind Israel. And in fact, Barack Obama signed the largest aid package to Israel in history. So I think, you know, some of these things don't necessarily, I think your point is that Israel has been highly favorable towards the United States for a very long time, and that's reflected in our politics. We've got time for about one or two more. Over here, right here, the gentleman in the suit.
Yes. My name is Kunio Kikuchi, and a former royal banker. So U.S. has been in the leadership for 70 years, and wants to spread and defend democracy by crushing opponents around the world and has killed millions of people in the process. China has been a developing country most of the time and only a leadership role in the last 5 or 10 years. And it sends troops of engineers and lots of money to build ports and so forth. So if we are a peace-loving country around the world, don't you think if this trend continues another 5 years and you conduct the same survey, I would say many, many tekel, the handwriting is on the wall, the world is going to perhaps come to a different conclusion unless the U.S. changes its ways? Thank you.
Well, you know, I guess in some ways your question might get at Chinese soft power, right? What do people around the world think about different elements of China's image? I mean, one thing that we do see often that's welcomed in many of the countries that we survey is economic investment from China. You know, that people have positive attitudes about China's growing economic role in many parts of the world. We see that, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, we've asked questions about that in the past. Where China's been very active. You know, we see that people have a positive view about China's growing economic role within their countries and investment, things like that. Where we don't see China get very high marks is on that question we ask about respecting the personal freedoms of its citizens. We ask the same question that we ask about the United States, about China, and when we do, we tend to see people around the world saying they don't think that the government of China respects the individual liberty of its citizens. They're more likely to say that the United States does, even though those numbers have come down over time. So if you're looking at, you know, China's soft power, that particular element of it is a place where the U.S. has a comparative advantage over China.
Great, we've got time for one more. Gentleman right here.
David Sobelson, Washington, D.C. First of all, how would your overall numbers have changed if instead of telling us the median, you gave us a population-adjusted average. And the other question is, I would guess that everybody in this room cares about the result of this study. How do we convince the people who are not in this room to care about the result of the study?
Well, it's a good question about, you know, we use these medians. They're very kind of rough summary kind of measures because we think it conveys the overall findings in a kind of easily digestible way. We haven't done a lot of adjusting for population in terms of, you know, the countries in our survey. In some ways, just because, you know, the nation state is still the fundamental unit of international affairs. So we want to look at countries rather than saying, you know, lumping them all together and adjusting for population or something like that. But so I'm not really sure. We haven't done that kind of analysis. In terms of, you know, spreading the word, you know, we try to get our research out in the media. We try to get our research out among policymakers and to make it an important part of conversations about important issues. So we do our best, and we try to, you know, have events at places like CSIS, and that helps us spread the word a bit. So that's a big part of our mission, is to get our research out there. You know, we're not looking for academic audiences as much as we are for the sort of informed public, for policymakers, for the media, for people who are involved in these kind of conversations. So we're going to keep working at it.
Did you want to jump in on that?
Well, I would just say, you know, again, it gets back to my question, you know, why does this matter? Because what, to horribly paraphrase a Winston Churchill quote, you know, a country with the most allies wins. We never want to be isolated. Yes, America has extraordinary economic and military power, but we know that we cannot do anything impactful alone. That's why we need allies and countries to support our goals, our objectives, our interests. It makes America safer. It makes us a more prosperous country. So this gives us, and we have, when other countries view us favorably as a country in the direction that we're going, and if they can provide that benefit of our leaders, they are more willing to follow American leadership because we're about protecting America's interests. That is the most positive America First policy I can put forward to you, but we need others to join with us, and we need to earn their respect. We need to galvanize them through leadership and move them in that direction. And the opinion polling that we saw here is just, it's working against those vital interests. Maybe you have a better way of putting it.
Well, I would, if Rick will forgive me, I would just to plug another survey that came out.
Oh, you.
Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which surveyed American attitudes about the world. Makes a nice set, and a number of journalists have picked up on the two. And what that survey shows is that Americans are more supportive of trade, more supportive of alliances, more supportive of global engagement in immigration. I can't prove it, but I think Pew deserves some credit for American attitudes changing in that way, and in the last 2 years becoming more positive about and understanding about the consequences of our actions in the world and the importance of global engagement, institutions, alliances to us. And I do think, although I can't prove it as a sort of anecdotally, I do think Pew's surveys are coming back into that discussion.
I'd like to thank Richard. I'd like to thank Pew for the tremendous survey work that they do. We obviously consume it a lot here at CSIS. And to your question, again, if you look at Twitter or if you look at almost any media company, they have this survey featured in it. And it's an important survey. I know you all saw it, but I hope you read it as well. I took tremendous pleasure in reading it a couple times. I want to thank Heather Conley and Mike Green, and thanks to all of you for being such a terrific audience. Thanks very much.